Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ross Kamage, and to begin, he commented on the rapidly evolving world of tumor mutations in non-small cell lung cancer and the evolving role of EML4-ALK.
The ALK story is certainly one of the fastest developing stories in lung cancer. For me, it all started about 2006. So in 2006, there was a phase one study of a drug which didn't have a name, which later turned into crizotinib. And the phase one study always knew that this was a drug that was a MET inhibitor, but also had some activity against ALK. And when they got to the recommended phase two dose, they planned to accrue cohorts with tumors pre-selected for evidence of either MET or ALK activation. Now, when that study started in 2006, most of the investigators were focused on the MET story because ALK hadn't been described in lung cancer. It had been described in some rare lymphomas and inflammatory myofibroblastic tumors. But I think most of us thought we would be lucky if we ever saw one of those cases to put into the study. And then in 2007, a Japanese group described ALK gene rearrangements in about 4% of lung cancer. There's some debate as to what the exact frequency is. And in late 2008, the two of the centers involved in that phase one study, Massachusetts General Hospital and University of Colorado, had the wherewithal to start to test lung cancer patients. And we were very lucky that we had a very large group of ALK-positive patients who came to us and got very early and extensive experience with these patients. And that led on to a very large expanded cohort in ALK-positive lung cancer, which led to the accelerated approval in August 2011. And only last week, we saw a press release announcing that the second-line randomized study, which is called PROFILE-1007, which is crizotinib compared to either pemetrexed or docetaxel in the second-line setting, had delivered a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival, but we don't know any details yet.
So I guess a few related questions, which is, first, what's the usual duration of response that's seen with crizotinib with these tumors? And what do we know about what happens when patients progress, what the tumors are like? And you all presented some data at ASCO related to that.
So the median progression-free survival is between 9 and 10 months. But the devil's very much in the details. So we presented at this year's ASCO that about 46% of ALK-positive patients, when the crizotinib stops working, it stopped working because they're progressing within the brain. And importantly, about 85% of those, that's the only site of progression at the time. So really the brain is standing out as like the Achilles heel for crizotinib. And if you were to take the people who just failed in the brain out of that equation, the actual duration of systemic control is probably quite a lot longer. Within the phase one study and other studies with crizotinib, if you progressed in the brain, indeed, even if you progressed in some other sites, and you treated them, for example, with radiotherapy, you were allowed to keep the drug going. Obviously, you were logged as progression for the purposes of data capture. But when we looked at our own series, for the people who just progressed in the brain, if you treated them with radiotherapy and kept the drug going, it took on average 7 months before you saw any other side of progression. So although the official number is 9 or 10 months, if you're creative about how you try and control people's disease, you can really extend out disease control for many more months.
Are there a subset of patients receiving crizotinib who, you know, a small subset who remain in response, you know, years later?
Well, we don't have a big enough data set. So the first patient was treated in late 2008. I think the longest I've had a patient on is about 3 years. But I would say that most of my patients now have required some kind of radiotherapeutic weeding of the garden, as it were, to sort of delete some of these clones popping up.
So what do we know about when patients actually clearly have disease progression on crizotinib?
So the total number of ALK-positive crizotinib-treated patients who've been re-biopsied at progression, so you biopsy a growing lesion and analyzed, in the entire world is probably less than 50. So our total data set is relatively small. The two biggest series come from the University of Colorado and again from Massachusetts General Hospital. And we can see certain things in common between those series and certain things that differ. In common, we can see that just like with the T790M story with EGFR mutations, you do get additional mutations occurring in the ALK kinase domain, which seem to alter their sensitivity to crizotinib. But unlike with T790M, there are many, many different ones. And it may be that EGFR already has one activating mutation, and there's a constraint on the other mutations you can accommodate in the kinase domain and still have a functional kinase. Whereas because ALK is actually activated by a gene rearrangement, you have a virgin kinase domain, and it's a lot more like CML, where many, many different mutations can exist as mechanisms of resistance. The other mechanism resistance that is common between the two series is copy number gain of the rearranged gene. Now, that's a relative term. You've increased the number of copies compared to your baseline. We don't have a feel for an absolute value. It's a fold change, sort of 3 to 4-fold over what you had. And in the lab, again, that seems to predict for resistance to crizotinib. If you add those things together, so all those things are doing is just reinstituting ALK signaling in the presence of crizotinib, it's probably running about 40 or 50% of cases.
You were part of some work presented at ASCO looking at visual effects of crizotinib, and also I've seen that you've done some work looking at gonadal effects.
Yeah, so the visual effects comes on really quickly with the crizotinib, within days of taking the drug. It's classically at the edges of the patient's vision, usually in low light conditions. And what happens is you either see flashing lights or smearing of lights. Occasionally you can see high registration images like the banisters on the staircase will flip registration. It slowly gets better over time, and that may be because the visual system slowly adapts. But it's not harmful in any way. It doesn't stop people driving, doesn't stop them watching the TV. I warn patients about it because otherwise they think something weird is going on. But mostly it's a mild amusement. It's a paper side effect more than anything that's going to interfere with somebody's life.
So now I see you have this paper in Cancer that was just published looking at hypogonadism.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of cool story. So it goes back to the idea that I think when we start to molecularly profile our patients, and when we listen to our patients, we can really spot patterns that, you know, might have been overlooked. So it's low testosterone in males taking crizotinib, and that was not picked up in the initial phase one. And the story goes back to a 35-year-old patient of mine who had been on the crizotinib, and his cancer had melted away. He was doing fantastic on it. And he came and he said, "I feel exhausted. You know, has anyone else got this?" And I was going, "Well, you know, people get a bit of fatigue, but not much." And you know, we kind of blew it off and we checked his thyroid function and everything else looked fine. And then he came back in a few weeks later and he said, "I want you to check my testosterone." And I was going, "Why?" Now, this is a young man. So ALK positivity is associated with younger people as possibly a slight male preponderance. But I have a number of young men who are on crizotinib. And this guy had, you know, got his life back. He'd responded to the treatment and he'd gone out and he'd got himself a new girlfriend. And he was noticing some element of erectile dysfunction. And he said, "I want you to check my testosterone." Now, to see this guy, he's about 6'2" and he's got a beard and he rides a Harley Davidson. And I said, "You're crazy, but I'll check it anyway." And it was amazingly low. And I thought, that's a little odd. Now, we know you can get low testosterone with advanced cancer if you've been through chemotherapy. So we essentially started to look in both the patients on crizotinib and in, a control group of my other advanced stage lung cancer patients who were just on standard therapy. And, you know, consistent with previous literature data, you get low testosterone in about 30% of people who've got advanced cancer who are on treatment. But it was low in 100% of the men who were on crizotinib. And when we tracked it longitudinally, it could be normal before they went on the crizotinib and it would drop to below the lower limit of normal within about 3 weeks of starting the crizotinib.
Now, what's going on with the rest of the endocrine profile, including the gonadotropins?
So we looked at that. So if you looked at LH and FSH, whereas you'd expect them to go up as part of a feedback loop, they actually stayed the same, or in some people actually went down. So from that, we conclude that there has to be a central effect. There has to be something affecting either the hypothalamus or the pituitary. We can't rule out a direct testicular effect, and certainly ALK is expressed in the testes, but we don't know that this is an ALK effect. It's just a crizotinib effect. And the great thing is when you find these people, I send them all to the endocrinologists and they talk through the pros and cons of testosterone replacement. And at least in my experience, the older you are and the more you have benign prostatic hypertrophy, the less you benefit from testosterone replacement. You actually feel worse on it and your prostate symptoms get worse. But if you're a 35-year-old guy, it's the difference between night and day. I mean, these people feel fantastic and they go to the gym and they start running marathons. So I think particularly because of the demographics who are ALK positive, this preponderance of younger people, a slight preponderance of males, checking it in everybody, and at least in my experience, if it's normal the first time you check it, recheck it because it's going to fall again. And then you're not making the decision about testosterone replacement. Send them to the expert and they can talk through the pros and cons.
So your motorcycle rider is doing well?
Yeah. Amusingly enough, he then left his girlfriend and the argument is became more like a man and less sensitive. But he's doing great.
Great.
Can you comment on the other major mutation story that's evolved recently, the ROS1 gene rearrangement, and evidence that crizotinib helps?
So crizotinib is the gift that keeps on giving. So we've had the ALK story. There had been a few case reports already published with regard to its activity in MET gene amplified lung cancer and esophageal cancer that came out in the journals a year or so ago. And this year at ASCO, we saw the new kid on the block, ROS1 gene rearrangements. So these are similar to ALK in the sense it's the kinase domain of something else fused to somebody else's promoter in a dimerization motif. They're rare. They're less than 1% of lung cancer. They respond as well to crizotinib as the ALK positive patients do. And I think that will probably add to a slight label expansion.
Have you yourself had any patients with ROS1 treated?
Yes, I have a patient who would be negative for everything else. He was actually a medical oncologist with lung cancer.
Wow, non-smoker?
Non-smoker. And he had obviously, you know, sought us out. He says, I want you to test me for everything. And we tested him for everything. Everything was negative. The ROS1 story had only broken a few months ago. We developed our own assay. And he was the first positive that we got. He'd been through carboplatin and pemetrexed and bevacizumab with really minimal response. And we put him straight onto the crizotinib within the study. And he had a beautiful response, came on rapidly. The irony is about 6 weeks after he started taking the crizotinib, he actually developed a bowel perforation for completely independent reasons. He had a diverticular abscess that popped. And he had to come off the crizotinib because he was very unwell and was in the intensive care. And when he came back, he got his first CT scan, officially per the study. And he was recorded as having progressed, but he'd been off the drug for many weeks. And if you look in the waterfall plot that Alice Shaw presented at this year's ASCO, he's actually one of the progressing patients. The fascinating thing was he was treated in an outside hospital for his bowel perforation, but if we got his CT scan, his preoperative CT scan, we had a glancing view of the lung bases, and he was clearly still responding at that point in time. And so Pfizer were kind enough to allow me to re-challenge him when he'd recovered from the bowel operation, and he re-responded again.
Wow.
And so he'd come off the drug, not because the drug wasn't working, but because of other medical reasons, and he had about another 6 or 7 months disease control.
Wow. What happened after that?
Unfortunately, his cancer then progressed through it, and he's no longer with us.
Got to ask what it's like to take care of a medical oncologist in this kind of situation.
Well, people often say that, you know, you should look after your patients as if they're a member of your family. And when they do the same profession of you, that brings it even closer to home. So I hope that I treated him as well as someone would treat me.
So a couple other sort of related questions that sort of flashed through my mind as you were talking about a number of these things. First is the issue of patients with EGFR mutations who respond to an EGFR TKI and then progress. And you were talking about mechanisms of resistance. But first of all, from a practical point of view, I'm hearing investigators talking about, you know, quote, keeping the EGFR TKI going and then starting something else like chemo. What do you think about that strategy?
So there are two approaches, and I don't think we know which is the best one. So one is that the TKI is suppressing some of the cells and you keep it going and you add in chemotherapy to treat the resistant cells. So you have to start to view the cancer as a mixed population. The other approach is you play what's called clonal warfare. So people already know that T790M is a more indolent form of EGFR mutant disease. It grows slower, both in the laboratory and now we have data in patients that it appears to be growing slower. So when you take someone off an EGFR TKI, these sensitive cells, which are not dead but have just been suppressed, will grow up and they will compete out the T790M. We see Darwinian evolution going on within patients. And that's why you get this re-response, sometimes even after a relatively short time. What we don't know, therefore, is in the long term, is it better to stay on the TKI, add in chemotherapy and keep the TKI going, you know, no matter what, or to have a period of time off the TKI, go on to chemo, untrain the cancer to be resistant, and then when the chemo stops working, re-challenge. Certainly, I've played it both ways. I've tended to do the latter slightly more commonly, and maybe that's, I don't know if it's the right thing or the wrong thing, but it's certainly very satisfying to re-challenge somebody after several months on chemotherapy and get a re-response. It's usually not as deep a response. It doesn't last quite as long because those resistant cells, although they've been diluted a little bit by the sensitive cells coming up, are still at much higher levels than in a TKI-naive patient.
Any comments on afatinib, including what was presented at ASCO, but also what was presented at last ASCO with cetuximab and afatinib?
So afatinib is an irreversible pan-HER inhibitor. It hits HER1, EGFR, HER2, and HER4, although we don't know the significance of HER4 to date. At this year's ASCO, we saw the results of LUX-Lung3, which was a first-line study, patients proven to have an EGFR mutation. And like many other studies before it, it was comparing this EGFR TKI, plus the other things that afatinib does, compared to first-line chemotherapy, in this case, cisplatin and pemetrexed, up to about 6 cycles. And as with all of those other studies, EURTEC, Optimal, aspects of IPASS, giving the targeted therapy to a molecularly selected population appeared to be better in terms of progression-free survival than the standard chemotherapy. The difference in progression-free survival was something like 6.9 months in the chemo arm and just over 11 months in the afatinib arm. They were aggressive. They included all different types of EGFR mutations, not just L858R and exon 19 deletions, but some of the rare mutations. And they're probably slightly bad actors. They may respond to afatinib, but they're still not as responsive as the other mutations. And they also did a subset analysis where if they took those out and just included the classical EGFR mutations in the afatinib-treated arm, the PFS was now just over 13 months, although that may be mild massaging of the data. The question is, what does that mean? Is this just a drug that if it gets an FDA license, and if it does, it'll be the first FDA license, which will be mutation-specific in the EGFR category in the US? But will that just mean that afatinib will now be sitting on the shelf in the pharmacy next to alotinib? But is there anything that's going to make somebody use it as opposed to alotinib in that setting, even though alotinib doesn't technically have a mutation-specific license? I think some people are worried that the toxicity with afatinib does appear to be more than with alotinib. The grade 3 rate of diarrhea, rash, and paronychia is in the sort of 10 to 20% range. And that's grade 3. I mean, these are severely toxic drugs in some individuals, and they require dose reductions. So I think there is a planned head-to-head study against gefitinib going on in the Far East. And I think that will be very informative in terms of really seeing the side effects head-to-head and really seeing in a molecularly selected population whether afatinib is any better or worse than the traditional reversible EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
What about cetuximab afatinib?
So that's a very interesting story. So the EGFR mutants who develop acquired resistance, although we've talked about keeping the drug going to sort of slow the disease down, forcing it to sort of move forward in low gear, we've talked about adding in chemotherapy or switching to chemotherapy for a period of time. But the holy grail is, can we find something that will really get the disease back under control with the same level that we saw when we first put somebody on alotinib? And the only thing that's shown any significant activity to date is this combination of afatinib and cetuximab. It came out of very nice preclinical work from William Powell's lab when he was initially at Sloan Kettering and now at Vanderbilt. And there seems to be something specific about the irreversible inhibitors as opposed to the reversible ones. So alotinib and cetuximab doesn't seem to be cutting it. We've seen data on a group of people who are EGFR mutant with acquired resistance, and it's very tightly defined. You had to be progressing on the alotinib, and within 30 days of stopping the alotinib, you had to go onto the study. So there's no re-challenge effect that we thought was going on. And we were seeing a response rate of about 45%. And intriguingly, it was independent of whether it was T790M positive or negative. The argument is that with the antibody and the irreversible inhibitor, you were just shutting down all EGFR signaling. And not surprisingly, the side effects reflect that. Diarrhea is not so much of an issue, but the skin toxicity is pretty severe. It takes a few weeks to come on, but pretty much when people have been on this combination for a few months, their skin doesn't feel like theirs. It's drier, It's less pliable. They often have drying of the mucous membranes on the eye, the mouth, the nose, vagina, anus. They can get hair loss with scabbing and weeping of the scalp. I mean, it's tough to keep people going. And we are very aggressive in terms of upfront use of moisturizers and doxycycline. And I think finding how to take these toxic drugs and make them tolerable in the long term is going to be a challenge, but it can be done. I mean, we managed to do it with chemotherapy many years ago.
So I really want to get onto your cases, but I've got to ask you about anti-PD-1.
I'm glad you asked me about that. It's one of the ones that I feel I can comment on because I was nothing to do with the trial. And it's really incredibly exciting. So PD-1, programmed death 1, is a receptor on the surface of tumor-infiltrating T lymphocytes. And on some cancers, they express the ligand for that, which is called PD-L1. And when that ligand interacts with the receptor, the T cell is pushed away. It doesn't start to attack the cancer. So they have developed a blocking antibody, a blocking PD-1, i.e. releasing that brake on the immune system, and now these infiltrating T cells can come in and start to attack the cancer. And what we saw at ASCO was information on both non-small cell lung cancer, renal carcinoma, and melanoma. And in the non-small cell lung cancer group, they were seeing responses even in the dose escalation phases, and then at the recommended dose, which is 10 milligrams per kilogram, they were seeing a response rate of about 10 to 20% in adenocarcinoma and 40 to 50% in squamous cancer. And these are heavily pretreated people. The numbers are still small. I mean, this is less than 100 patients that we're talking about in total. But really, just the idea that this might suddenly mean immune therapy is actually going to be a reality in lung cancer. And I think also, even more importantly, among those patients, one of them was an EGFR mutant patient with acquired resistance to Alotinib. And the idea that these immune therapies might cut across some of these genetic boundaries that we've started to draw, those pie charts that we've started to draw, may need to have something overlaid completely on top of it in terms of immune therapy. The one thing to point out, though, is this is not a panacea. The response rate is not 100%. It's not working in everybody. So we're going to have to find biomarkers for who needs a PD-1 antagonist just as much as we will for any of the TKIs. And if we don't, if we try and adopt a, hey, this works in everybody, let's develop it in everybody, that's really a step in the wrong direction. That's the figatumumab model, which I think is a broken paradigm.
And I guess from what I can understand, it seems like the autoimmune side effects with this is less than maybe what was seen, say, with Ipi.
It's less than with ipilimumab, but it's not insignificant. So they had a sort of 8 to 10% pneumonitis rate, if I recall correctly. Again, that comes back to the idea that this is not a free lunch. We need some kind of biomarker, and there are candidates looking at immunohistochemistry for the receptor or the ligand, for example. We need a biomarker to decide who is going to benefit most and who should not be unnecessarily exposed to these side effects.
So I'd like to close out by trying to cover as much of the cases as we can. These are great cases and great discussion points. Maybe we can start out with your 59-year-old man. And, you know, you don't have to go through every single part of the story, but maybe just sort of the key aspects of the case and what you think it means.
So this is a 59-year-old Caucasian male. He was a retired executive from the cosmetics industry. And he was completely well. He's a very fit individual. And he went for an executive medical, and they did a cardiac scan, and with absolutely no symptoms at all, they found a 2.5 centimeter right upper lobe spiculated mass. He was worked up in an outside institution. They did the PET CT scan, they did an MRI of his brain, and he proceeded to an open thoracotomy. This was in 2008, and I guess the outside institution was still doing those. And two things came out. First of all, although the PET CT scan was negative, he had both subcarinal and hilar lymph nodes positive on pathology. And perhaps more importantly, at the time of the operation, which hadn't shown up at all on the scans, multiple pleural seedlings were noted, which were biopsied and again shown to be positive. So he had the primary resected, he had the lymph node dissection, but he's now known to have pleural disease and N2 disease, and it turned out to be a TTF1 positive adenocarcinoma. So we're left in the situation where I know this man now has stage 4 disease. He has M1A disease in the new classification, but I can see nothing on the scan. And I had to decide what to do. So I did two things. He was a never smoker, so I sent off molecular testing, which at that point in time was taking a few weeks to come back. And he was very anxious at that point in time, and he wanted to do something quicker. So I decided to treat him with what you might call pseudo-adjuvant treatment, because there was nothing I could see on the scans. I couldn't just keep the treatment going and going and going because I wouldn't know if it was working or not. So I gave him 4 cycles of cisplatin and docetaxel. And cisplatin, because that's the platinum that has most evidence in the adjuvant setting. And why docetaxel? Well, I often say to the fellows, you can do anything you like as long as you can justify it. So there had been some data that although most platinum doublets appeared comparable, there was one study led by Frank Fisella a few years ago that showed that cisplatin docetaxel was slightly better than a vinorelbine-based regime. So that was why. It was tough, but he got through the 4 cycles.
I guess I would ask, I mean, it sounds like maybe you were holding out hope. I mean, if you knew for sure he had bone mets or something, would you still have given him chemo like that?
Yeah, I mean, he was asymptomatic, so I guess I could have waited for the molecular test results to come back, which turned out to be informative, as you'll hear. But he, you know, you've always got to remember that the patient in front of you has got a brain and emotions, and he wanted to do something, and he wanted to do it now.
So what happened with the molecular testing?
So he turned out to have an exon 19 EGFR mutation. And because of that, even though there was nothing showing up on his scans, because I knew he had stage 4 disease, I do what I don't normally do. So I don't give alotinib in the adjuvant setting traditionally. But this was a slightly different situation. I knew he was going to recur. And following his chemotherapy, I put him directly onto alotinib. And that was in August 2008. And he did incredibly well. No disease turned up until July 2011. And so I can't do that in my head, but that's sort of 2 and a bit years. 2 things happened. One was I'd become aware of what we talked about earlier, that the brain was a partial sanctuary site for some of these TKIs. And I changed my practice to start to institute routine MRIs of the brain for people on TKIs who had long-term disease control, usually once a year. And he got one in July 2010 and it was fine. But by July 2011, he had a 5 millimeter left parietal CNS lesion, which I treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. About a month later, he had his regular PET CT scan, because that's how I'd been following him, and he had a bony lesion light up. Now, I tend to follow patients if they have a tumor marker. I tend to track that longitudinally. Not everybody has them, but CEA in some patients can be a very informative marker, and his CEA had been normal, and then it went 4, and then it went to 7, and about that time, that's when the lesion showed up in the bone. And that comes back to kind of what we were talking about. This isn't game over. Pleural disease hadn't lit up. Everything else is nicely controlled. This is an aberrant clone, which has developed a resistance mutation, and at least according to the PET scan, is relatively localized. So I kept the TKI going. He stayed on the alotinib, and I treated that area with radiotherapy.
The bone?
Yes, the left iliac wing lesion I treated with radiotherapy.
With sort of a, you know, obviously it wasn't palliative.
Well, so that's where you have to get your whole team up to speed. So the radiation oncologist initially gave a palliative dose. He gave 18 gray in a single fraction to the bone, you know, because he was thinking about pain control. And the CEA dropped a little bit, but there was still residual activity on the PET scan in that bone lesion. And the SUV had dropped from 17 to 7, I think. But within about 3 or 4 months, the CEA was going up again. PET CT, all it showed was that area, same area, starting to heat up again. Now the SUV was 13.5. So I spoke to my radiation oncologist and I said, could you turn the machine on this time? And I mean, I think he's very much gone on the same journey with me, the whole idea about deleting these areas, not just palliating them. And this time we gave 36 gray in 3 fractions. And that was in April of this year. And he's done fine. CEA is now completely back to normal. PET scan's completely normal. He remains on the alotinib. So just by weeding the garden, we've extended out the disease control by the alotinib.
I never know in our CME programs how to provide balance in terms of kids don't do this at home type thing, but I guess really you tried to adapt to his attitude and his age and his desires and I guess the individuality of him.
Well, you got to think what your alternative is. So his alternative is to go back onto some kind of cytotoxic chemotherapy or to put him on some kind of experimental regime which may or may not work. I'm sure he will go on to these at some point in the future, but this is just a way of, you know, making hay while the sun shines.
I'm just thinking about your overall approach to the case. You mentioned that, quote, you don't use EGFR TKIs in the adjuvant setting, Maybe you can just comment briefly on the SELECT trial that was presented at ASCO.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. So the SELECT study was patients known to have an EGFR mutation who went on to, it wasn't randomized, it was a single arm study, went on to alotinib for 2 years. And you can look at the data in two ways. The first is, after 2 years, they had a 94% disease-free survival rate, which is fantastic. And these are people who were stage 1 through 3A. And there was a subtle difference by stage, but really fantastic disease control. So you might take that away and say, therefore, we should give alotinib in the adjuvant setting for people that we know have an EGFR mutation. If you looked at the disease-free survival rate in years 3 and 4, when you'd stop the alotinib, it was like 60% and 40%. You had this incredibly rapid drop-off in disease-free survival. And I think what that's telling you is that alotinib isn't a cell killer. This isn't like cisplatin. This isn't shifting people from not cured to cured. What it's doing is controlling the disease in people who have low-level metastatic disease. And you can take that away that the logical extension is maybe there's a group of people who do have metastatic disease at presentation. The alotinib isn't going to cure them. And maybe they need the alotinib going forever and ever. But the health economic implications of that are huge. But that's what I took away from the SELECT. Fantastic control when you're on the drug, and then it really drops off when you're off. So since we're still figuring out, we're still feeling out the whole adjuvant role, how well we've staged these people, whether they need chemotherapy and then the alotinib, at the moment it's not part of my routine practice.
Kind of has a little bit of a CML feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Maybe we can finish out with your 59-year-old lady.
So she's another ALK-positive patient, and you'll see certain similarities in how I do things. So she was 59 years old, never smoker, presented with cough. She had a 2.5-centimeter left lower lobe mass and some hilar activity. She proceeded to a pneumonectomy and lymph node dissection in an outside institution, and she was found to be T2N2M0 with a TTF1-positive adenocarcinoma. She'd received some neoadjuvant chemotherapy, 4 cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel. I think they were hoping to avoid the pneumonectomy. The mass was relatively close to the hilum, but they weren't able to, and she still had the pneumonectomy. But it wasn't that long before disease started to show up again. So that was all in the middle of 2008. In February 2009, she had PET activity in mediastinal lymph nodes, which she had radiotherapy to. It was biopsy-confirmed recurrence. And then in June 2009, she now presented with more widespread disease, adrenal disease, kidney disease, and within the liver. And that's when she came to see us at the university. And we sent off molecular testing, as we tend to do on most people these days. And because she was asymptomatic, she went off on a trip. And when she came back from the trip, which she'd had to interrupt because she started to develop blood in her urine and she got very scared, she came back from a trip early, I was fortunate enough to be able to tell her that she was ALK positive. And she went on to crizotinib in the clinical study. She was one of the first patients we put on in August 2009. Hematuria stopped within days, so their response rate is very rapid with these oncogene-addicted diseases. And by the time she had her first PET CT scan, she'd had a complete response.
Then what happened?
Well, she tolerated the treatment well, but after about 10 months, and remember that's the magical progression-free survival number that's been reported, she developed a single area in the right adrenal gland lighting up. So very similar to the EGFR story I just told you, an isolated clone popping up. We tried to biopsy it, but we couldn't get enough tissue. So again, I treated that with radiotherapy, 30 gray in 3 fractions. And she got 4 months before a regional lymph node, a retroperitoneal lymph node, lit up again. So I thought, I'm not going to overthink this. I gave her SBRT again. But now it was only 2 months before another lymph node in that same chain popped up. And you know, again, we're still starting to feel when it's appropriate to do this SBRT and when it's just a crazy doctor who doesn't know when to give up. The assumption was because these were cropping so frequently that it was more widespread disease. And so at that point in time, I said, well, we're not going to do more SBRT. And although at that point in time, we're nearly 2 years on the crizotinib, having extended out her disease control, I stopped the crizotinib. She had a mild flare in some of her symptoms, but that was only for about a week, some of the side effects. Her nausea, her diarrhea, and some peripheral edema got slightly worse, strangely enough, but then settled. I then put her on pemetrexed. And we had had a number of patients who had been on pemetrexed before they'd gone on crizotinib who'd done fantastically well, and we sort of molecularly profiled them. And we published that we wondered if there was an association with being ALK positive or other things associated with ALK positivity and benefit from pemetrexed. And so we hadn't really reported it after crizotinib, but I put this woman who'd failed crizotinib on pemetrexed, and she had a complete response again. And she has now had 23 cycles of pemetrexed with, apart from a solitary brain lesion that we treated with stereotactic radiosurgery, she has remained on the pemetrexed with absolutely perfect control of her disease. Almost, 2 years of pemetrexed now after almost 2 years on crizotinib.
How did she do on the crizotinib in terms of side effects? Did she have any of those visual effects? And how did she do on the pemetrexed?
She did have the visual side effects. She had some nausea. So crizotinib can give you nausea. It happens within a few hours of taking the drug. And it's definitely markedly improved if you have some food in your stomach. It's slightly counterintuitive. Most people, when they're nauseated, don't want to eat. But if you can get the food in there, the crizotinib is much better tolerated. She was fine. After she'd been on the crizotinib for maybe about 4 to 6 months, she started to get some peripheral edema. And that's really the only late onset side effect that we know of. It's very much like the peripheral edema that you can get with some of the other kinase inhibitors, like with sunitinib. It can be in random places. She got it in her ankles, but occasionally it would be on the back of one hand. Occasionally it'd be around one eye. And it largely settled by itself. If it gets bad, she'll take, furosemide, sort of 20 or 40 milligrams for a few days. But it seems to come and go. So generally speaking, she tolerated the treatment very well. Pemetrexed, it's like I'm giving her water. It's nothing to her.
So you had a series that was reported at the ASCO meeting looking at this issue of clinical benefit from pemetrexed before and after crizotinib in ALK-positive patients. What did the series show?
Well, it's a very small series. I think what we took away from it is that pemetrexed is an active drug in ALK-positive lung cancer. We don't entirely know. We don't know if it's because they're ALK-positive. Clearly, there tended to be adenocarcinoma. But when we did our initial analysis, we looked in adenocarcinoma that was EGFR mutant and KRAS mutant in a triple negative adenocarcinoma group. And the ALK group in a multivariate analysis stood out above everything else, above, all of the other molecular abnormalities, regardless of age, line of therapy, whether you gave it as monotherapy or combination therapy, whether you're a smoker or not. And we're still trying to feel this out. There have been some other series which have both confirmed this. So there's a Korean series which showed a 35% response rate to pemetrexed monotherapy in ALK-positive patients compared to a 3% response rate in EGFR mutant patients. And then there's a retrospective analysis in the patients who went on some of the crizotinib studies. I don't know how good quality that data is because that's sort of just what goes into the clinical report form. Here, they were still reporting a progression-free survival rate double what you would expect from historical series, but less than what we'd seen. I think the definitive answer is going to be from that randomized study, the Profile 1007, which is crizotinib versus pemetrexed or docetaxel, and that's going to be a nice, clean data set just to see the true extent of benefit. And it'll be very interesting to see if the docetaxel does differently from the pemetrexed in the patients who got one or the other.
So as you were talking about this lady, I was kind of flashing on, I'm guessing you've looked at FSH and LH in women on crizotinib.
Well, we have, but we haven't reported it. Now, it's only going to be informative in people who are premenopausal, and she's postmenopausal, so right. She's not a great example. What I can tell you is in the premenopausal women, they don't report any abnormality in their periods, but that doesn't tell me whether they're having anovulatory cycles or not, and that's still a work in progress.
Do you want to comment on either one of the last patients, maybe briefly?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'd like to comment on would probably be the marker negative non-squamous patient. Just to
triple negative.
Just to reinforce the idea that while we can recognize clinical factors which are associated with molecular abnormalities, that is not a substitute for testing. So this is a 54-year-old Chinese male computer programmer. He has a 5-pack year smoking history, but he quit 20 years ago. So he's got a lot of the factors that you would expect to be associated with an EGFR mutation. He'd done all the research and he came and he said, "You want to put me on alotinib? I've got this stage 4 cancer." And I said, "Let's wait for the results." He was asymptomatic, so we waited, and he was EGFR wild type. So I put him on carboplatin and pemetrexed and bevacizumab, and he's actually continued to respond. After 4 cycles, we dropped the carboplatin because it wasn't that great a response, but he stayed on the pemetrexed and bevacizumab as continuation maintenance. And every time I see him, his CE gets lower and his scans get smaller. But we checked him for everything else. We did the snapshot analysis. So he's KRAS wild type, BRAF wild type, PI3 kinase wild type. We've done FISH analysis for ROS1, ALK, and MET. He's had HER2 mutations assessed by a sizing assay, and he's on the wait list for the new RET FISH test we've got up and running.
So is this the way you normally approach wild-type metastatic patients, kind of like the Patel approach?
Well, I think when we see the results of that point break study, which is carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab, keeping the pemetrexed and bevacizumab going as continuation maintenance compared to the Sandler regime or the ECOG-4599 regime of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, and just keeping the bevacizumab going, if that's a positive study, and they set themselves a high bar, they're looking for overall survival as their primary endpoint. If that's a positive study, that I think will really shift, at least for non-squamous cancers, what the standard of care will be. I don't know if you're aware, there was the Paramount data and then there was the Avapearl data.
Right.
So Paramount was asking a simple question that said if you had carboplatin and pemetrexed for 4 cycles and you hadn't progressed, if you kept the pemetrexed going, was that better than stopping it? And the answer was yes. It had both a progression-free survival advantage of 1.3 months, and this year we saw it actually had an overall survival advantage of, I think, 1.9 months. The Avapearl study, which was presented at ESMO last year, was similar. It was carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab, and they compared keeping the bevacizumab going compared to keeping the bevacizumab and the pemetrexed going. And that showed a much more prominent progression-free survival advantage of about 4 months, and we haven't really seen up to date overall survival data, but there was a strong suggestion overall survival may be heading in the right direction too. And that Avapearl at 4 months is what drove me to give the carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab and keep the pemetrexed and bevacizumab going.